couple of years ago, really, the word unprecedented got rather worn out through the Brexit, particularly if you're a political nerd. Brexit was rather kind of exciting. There were all these cliffhanger votes, which basically the government lost, I think, all of them, including when Boris Johnson took power. So there was all these political commentators saying, oh, this is unprecedented. It's really unprecedented. Now it's really, really unprecedented what's happening. But that has been completely blown away by the use of the word this year. It has been an unprecedented year, meaning things very exceptional, unusual, unthinkable happened. It's been the year of COVID. There may have been other great triumphs or tragedies in your life, but I suppose as the big narrative for the world even, it's been the year of COVID. Things have happened that we never would have expected. A virus bringing whole civilizations almost to their knees, but not in a good way. Governments pretty much ending personal freedom and choice on the basis of some medical emergency. Anti-hugging laws, being paid to stay at home, and churches closed. Things that if I'd have been talking about them last year in a sort of, not that we do that in this church, but some kind of prophecy, would have been rather cool if I'd had a prophecy about that. And you'd have really listened to me. But that wasn't God's view and choice. But anyway, if I'd have said that last year, you would not have believed me. You'd have said, "Just you're being stupid. You're being paranoid. You're crazy." But it did happen. And what we look at this morning is in a league of its own, though. It was foretold, not like COVID, which was only by some sort of medical obscure people might have been thought about. It was foretold, but still, it was completely unprecedented, completely beyond words, fantastic. And that's what we're going to look at this morning, just in these few moments we've got left. First of all, from these verses, God comes to us. God comes to us. Sorry, I forgot to do a PowerPoint, so you just have to listen to me and look at me. God comes to us, first point. And that's really in kind of two halves. There's the physical, and then there's the sort of geographical, you might call it. There's the kind of what's going on physically, and then what's going on locationally and geographically. So God comes to us. First half of that is he becomes one of us. Second half of that is that he's living with us. So first of all, he becomes one of us. The Word became flesh. The Word became flesh. You know, these vaccines that have been recently developed, it's pretty remarkable. Whether you're a kind of an anti-vaxxer, whether you've got ideological reasons why you don't want to take them or medical worries and all those sort of things. Whatever you think about vaccines, it is a remarkable piece of science to sort of glue some bits of protein together and make them look like a COVID virus with the spike protein, and for T cells, an even more remarkable thing, and antibodies, an even more remarkable thing, to start attacking them and then figure out how they can attack COVID when it comes for real. That is a remarkable piece of science, this kind of welding together of molecules to make this RNA, DNA, whatever it is, NA, that pretends it's a COVID virus. But here in what John describes is something more remarkable. It's kind of remarkable on a completely different level. It's not just that it's kind of physically remarkable. You can't even get your head around it. It's just remarkable from every angle that you look at it, that God, the Word, the one who's been described at the beginning of this book, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Him, the Word, he becomes flesh. God the Eternal, verse 1, the Word, who was with God and was with God in the beginning. So the Eternal One, or as John the Baptist says in verse 15, that's the John he's talking about in verse 15, John testified concerning him. He cried out saying, "This is the one I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.'" He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. If John the Baptist was saying that, you imagine you're in the audience and John the Baptist says that. He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. And you're thinking, what does that mean? He comes after me, but he's before me because he's surpassed me. And John the Baptist there is expressing what John the Evangelist here is expressing, which is the eternal God who was before all of us and who always was, the eternal God, at a point in time, arrives. And he comes after John the Baptist. So he arrives at a point in time. John the Baptist has a birthday. Jesus has a birthday. So at a point in time, the Word becomes flesh. And yet, because he is the eternal Word, he surpasses John the Baptist and everyone else, all of us. And of course, he precedes in his person all of those people. But he was born after John the Baptist and after David and Moses and Abraham and all those people in time. So he becomes flesh. The Word, God, eternal God, creator God, becomes flesh. The one who created every cell, every protein, every chemical becomes flesh. The one who created the seas and the mountains and all the beasts of the earth and all the tiny things and all the massive things and all the stars in the sky becomes flesh and starts to see all those things with his eyes. And just like you, he has a heart and lungs and stomach and a skeleton, and it's all enclosed in skin. And he has a spirit within this living, breathing body. And at first, he needs to be carried and fed. And he's fragile and vulnerable and helpless. And he grows, and he's a young child, and he grows, and he's a young man, and he grows, and he's a man walking around, and eventually, age 30, starts preaching. But he still needs air, and he feels pain, and he gets tired, and he sees little fragments of creation with his eyes. The one who oversees everything is just seeing something in the moment. And he hears noise with his ears, and he lives and breathes, and then he dies as a man. The Word became flesh. And God is speaking. God is bringing light. That's not so remarkable, because if you'd read the Old Testament, if you'd lived through that time, if you were a Jew now listening to these words, you'd think, well, God speaking is not so remarkable. God bringing light is not so remarkable, because God speaks and he always brings revelation. But for God to bring light in this way is extraordinary. It really is unprecedented. It's a stunning reality that the light of the world is enclosed in this human frame. And if you were a Jew then, and if you were a Greek then, if you were a Roman then, if you were actually a person on the street now with no kind of background and no Christmas story, for Muslims all across the world, this is extraordinary to the point of being either ridiculous or perhaps blasphemous. It's kind of an insult to God, some people might even think. It's a ridiculous notion that the eternal God would join with flesh, dirty flesh, fallen flesh. Flesh that has to grub around with the rest of creation. It seems somehow inappropriate. It seems somehow illogical. How is that even possible for God to do that? Why would he even want to? But John says that's what's going on. The Word, the eternal God, the creator God, becomes, there's a moment in time, flesh, fully human. In this ultimate act of humility and love and association and practical empathy, he becomes flesh. That's the first half of the Word becomes flesh and dwelt among us. Second half of this God with us is living with us. So he becomes one of us, but secondly, under this heading, living with us. In the time of Moses, right back in the Old Testament, when God started to reveal himself in terms of the law and the sacrificial system in detail, in that time, the presence of God was located in a tent, what we call the tabernacle, which traveled around with Israel. There was very detailed instructions on how that tent was made, but ultimately it was a frame with some cloths over the top of it and divided up into some rooms inside. And John uses the same word here, the word that people who had the Jewish Bible would have been familiar with when he says, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He's using a word that they would have thought of was the word for the tabernacle. He tabernacled among us. He, you might say, camped among us. He spread his tent among us. And what is so remarkable is that this is the actual presence of God amongst us. You see, in the Old Testament, the presence of God was there, and it was great because if you were a Jew, wherever you traveled, you had the tabernacle in the middle of the congregation when you set up tent, where you're all kind of sleeping, you've arranged your tents all around. So whenever you looked up, the tent was there, the presence of God was there. So it was with you, but it was kind of remote from you because only the high priest could go in once a year to the Holy of Holies, and the whole thing was enclosed, and there was a degree of mystery and awesomeness and holiness about this place, which meant the presence of God was with you, but you weren't really with God in that way, in that close way, in that intimate way. There were moments, there were glimpses, there were foretastes, but you weren't actually there with God in that sense. But Jesus was the actual presence of God with us, dwelling with us, spreading his tent among us, no longer at a distance, up close and personal, could be seen and handled and touched and experienced. And he had a mother and brothers and a town where he was born, and he ate and drank and he slept our life. But not just that, he lived our life among us. I've actually got slept our life in the notes. What does that even mean? Lived our life among us. And he saw it firsthand. All of creation, as I said already, but he saw people living their lives with their heartaches, with their troubles. He felt compassion for people. He heard people speak and he interacted with them. He was up close to them. He held young children in his arms and blesses them. He eats with people, loads and loads of meals with people. He chats with people. He is totally immersed in our world. And he sees at first hand hatred and jealousy and death and pain and sin and hypocrisy. And he engages with those things. And he feels the impact of those things. And he's so close that people can grab hold of him and kill him. He lived completely among us. And as we think about those two things, the word became flesh and dwelled among us, made his dwelling among us, camped among us. If we think about those two things, what we first have to do really is just to stand back in awe, recognize that maybe we get a bit too familiar with it, that God is really with us. John's pretty amazed. See that verse 18? He says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God, and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." It's like John is having a kind of stand back moment and saying, yeah, the word became flesh. And do you know what that means? He's putting it in the context of the whole of the Bible and all the revelation of God and the fact that God was so holy and awesome and glorious, as we'll see in just a moment. And so he couldn't be experienced in this face-to-face way. There were just glimpses. There were just little moments where it was close to that, but never really that, never in this way. And John says, the one and only Son, God the Son, the one who was so close to the Father, inseparable from the Father, has revealed to us, has made him known to us. And we stand back in awe at that. And I think we then need to go on and having stood and worshipped and said, wow, this is amazing. As we start to understand what that means, we continue in worship, but we're also really encouraged in our faith. The fact that the word became flesh, truly human, meant that he could truly, really be a sacrifice for our sin. with the infinite capacity of being God, with the genuine human personhood of being a man, with that, he truly can be a sacrifice for sin. It's Jesus as a human being who dies on the cross for us. His flesh dies. His flesh is pierced with those wounds. His flesh is pierced with the nails. His flesh is beaten. His flesh dies. His body and spirit are ripped apart as he dies. He does that as a human. And for that to happen, the Word must become flesh. And it does. So your Savior this morning, if you're a Christian, is your Savior because he became flesh. And he's truly your Savior because he became flesh. So that's one thing to think about and to worship and to be encouraged in your faith about. But the other, of course, is that because he became flesh, he understands you. He became like his brothers, as the book of Hebrews tells us. He became like us in every way except for sin. He knows your need. He knows your feelings. He knows hunger and thirst and tiredness. He knows fear. He sees what people were fearing and troubled with. He sees all the effects of sin around him. He talks to people. He has compassion on people because he can see what's going on. And he completely sympathizes with you. He faced the cross and felt that the emotion of, this is a terrible, awful thing that I'm going to go through. And he felt that as a human being. And he sweats and it becomes almost like drops of blood because he is so intensely feeling it. He knows what it is to be human. There is no experience that you are going through that Jesus cannot sympathize with because the Word became flesh. There's no experience, no suffering, no pain, no loss, no hurt that Jesus can't sympathize with. He knows our weakness. He knows it as a creator, of course. But as a man, he feels it. He's touched with a feeling of our weakness. He knows us. That's the first point. God with us. Conscious that the children are separate from us. So I'm going to try and power through in the next 5 minutes and second 2 points. So second point, glory shown to us. It is a shorter point. Glory shown to us. I meant to say at the beginning, we're using kind of verse 15 as a sort of summary of verse 14 as a summary of 14 through to 18. So we're mainly looking at 14 and then using the other verses to kind of expand on it. So the Word became flesh, and then the next sentence, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son. We have seen his glory, and this really just expands on that point about the Word became flesh. You know, who is the Word? It's John saying that the glory of God, the awesome presence of God, is revealed to us. God's glory is a difficult word to define glory. If you ever kind of try and look it up and try and say, well, let's think of a really succinct, quick way of describing glory, it's quite hard. It's something to do with weight. That's kind of where the word comes from. Like the weight of loads of gold. If you're a king, you have sort of glory in the fact that you've got lots and lots of gold and it weighs a lot. It's that sort of idea of weight in terms of value. It's to do with majesty, again, with the king and the gold and the glory and all that kind of thing. It's maybe sometimes connected with brightness, of sort of intense, pure brightness. Back to Moses again. You know, in Exodus 33 and 34, he asked God, will you show me your glory? And God can't really show him face to face his glory. So he hides Moses in a rock and the glory of God is said to pass by. What's really interesting, though, is that as he passes by, he says some words. And we're going to think about them in our third point. But in terms of the actual experience of the face-on glory of God, Moses doesn't get it. He doesn't get that seeing the glory of God. He just sees a kind of fragment of it as the glory passes by and he's hiding away in a rock somewhere. And yet John says, now in Jesus, we have seen his glory. He says it, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son. And John might have been thinking about the time of the transfiguration. You know, when Jesus is on a mountain and he is transfigured, transformed, he looks completely different before them. And those three disciples there get a revelation of the glory, the splendor, the majesty of God. He might have been thinking about that. But I think he's thinking of that plus the whole experience of Jesus. And he's saying that whole experience of knowing Jesus is experiencing the glory of God here on earth. In his letter, John speaks in a similar way, the way he begins his first letter, 1 John, where he says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at, and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it, and we testify to it, and we proclaim it to you, the eternal life which is with the Father and has appeared to us." And then he talks about the fellowship that that brings. And what John is saying there and in his letter and in his gospel that we're looking at, he's saying the full weight of the character of God, of the splendor of God, is revealed to us in Jesus. It's seen in the transfiguration. It's seen right through his life. It's seen in the whole experience of the word becoming flesh. And so John wants to emphasize that it's glory that's been seen. But notice the point that he's making as he says that. He says, we have seen the glory. We have seen the glory. And it's really important to underline, especially at this Christmas time when we get wrapped up with all kinds of mythology, that what John is writing about is something that he himself has seen and experienced, and there were witnesses to it. He says, yes, it is glory, so I'll explain the kind of theological significance, but I'll also tell you it's something we actually experience. It's been seen by us. This mind-blowing concept that I'm describing to you is reported in a very mundane fashion. We saw it. We told people about it. We wrote it down. They're all historical reporters. So it's a tremendous, mind-blowing idea, but the experience of it is very ordinary. And in fact, that was God's design, that there would be witnesses, and the witnesses would tell others, and it would get written down, and that we would get to hear about it now. And that's an encouragement for us to believe those witnesses. Last point, grace given to us. So we thought about God with us. We thought about glory shown to us through the experience of John and the witnesses and through their testimony to us. And then thirdly, grace given to us. Grace given to us. You see, John says, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Just take us back to Moses. Take yourself back to Moses. And he's not experiencing the glory of God in the sense of face to face, the full-on experience of the majesty and power and brightness and holiness of God. He's not experiencing that. But what he experiences is God passing by, as I've said already. And what's really interesting is, as God passes by, words are spoken. And they're words that accompany this spectacular sight. And they talk about the two major characteristics of God. And they are steadfast love, kindness, grace, and faithfulness. So God, to Moses, declares, this is my character, steadfast love and faithfulness, truth. And when God really comes down from the mountain in the person of Jesus, when the word becomes flesh, when the glory of God is fully revealed, guess what? It could be summarized by grace and truth. Steadfast love, kindness, and faithfulness, truth. Let's think about grace. The glory of God comes full of grace, says John in verse 15. And then verse 16, he says, out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. (Clears throat) We have a recent tradition of having a kebab once a week. It's been prescribed by my doctor as a healthy thing, at least once a week. Have an orange once a week, have a kebab once a week. And the thing about kebabs is they're all the pouch is so ridiculously full, isn't it? Have you experienced that with a kebab? You know, I had a large sheesh, which was a bit greedy, really. Karen and I had to have a small sheesh because that's what I ordered for her. And the thing about the shish kebab, the doner's even worse, actually. And the doner's much nicer, but less healthy. But with the shish kebab, you get so much meat. And they sort of put that all in the pouch. And they put so much salad. And it's actually really nice salad. And then a few chilies and a few onions and a few other things. And it's piled on and piled on. And you sort of put it on your plate and it slithers around, as you know. And you try and get the paper off. Or you just stick it all in your mouth in one go, or whatever works for you. But it's so kind of lavish, I think. Do you think of a kebab as being lavish? Probably not. You think of it as being drunk person's food or something. But it's phenomenal. There's so much of it. I felt so ill on Thursday night after eating one. We had chips with it as well. And that was like the idea of grace upon grace. You'll never forget that now. But it's the idea of full and overflowing, bursting out, piling on good stuff upon more good stuff, loads of beautiful meat and loads of beautiful salad, actually beautiful salad, salad you might like, and then tomatoes and onions and chilies and stuff like that, and then, I don't know what else, chips on top of that. It's grace upon grace. And that's the idea that John is trying to put across here when he says grace upon grace. He says God is layering up grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. It's what you call it in posh words, a superlative term. Grace upon grace already given. What he means is God has shown grace and love already, but he shows more. And now in Jesus, the loving kindness he shows surpasses everything he's already done, anything he's already done, but it also kind of continues to build and build and build because it's grace upon grace upon grace. There is so much grace. It is extravagant grace. And that's what comes in the Word becoming flesh and truth. Moses brings the law down when he's finished speaking with God. Christ comes to fulfill the law in all truth. He comes to speak the truth with his phenomenal capacity to teach. And every word he says is true and trustworthy. And he comes to live the truth in fullness, but also to die for our failure to know the truth and to live the truth ourselves. So when Jesus comes, he comes with grace and truth, and those two things meet perfectly when Jesus dies. Because when Jesus dies, there is this superlative piling on of grace upon grace upon grace as Jesus, in his loving kindness, lays down his life in our place and is a perfect sacrifice for us because the Word became flesh. But also at the cross, truth is completely, fully revealed. Because as Jesus dies, the justice of God is satisfied. The truth of God is proclaimed. The faithfulness of God is authenticated. It's not like God stops becoming holy for a minute to forgive you. He carries on being holy. He carries on being righteous. He carries on being the God of truth. And yet, he's the God of grace who gifts you with eternal life, who gifts you with forgiveness. And this morning, friends, we've just been circling around these great truths, and I'm just trying to encourage you to feel them. But if you're not a Christian this morning, it's imperative, it's so important that you understand that there is a gift on offer for you which satisfies the truth of God, that Jesus fully proclaims to you the grace of God and the truth of God, the faithfulness of God. And you need to hear about that grace. And it's a free gift of God, and it takes away all our guilt and shame. You You see, sometimes we think that our problems, I know I've gone over, but I'll do a couple more minutes. Sometimes we think that our problems are that we've been let down by bad relationships, or that we've made terrible mistakes in the past that we regret. We got angry, we got out of control, we got drunk, we slept around, we had all kinds of things in our lives that we did wrong. Or we think it's not to do with our moral failure, it's to do with just our weakness. And we think, I'm just a weak person, I've got poor health. Or I'm just a weak person, I can't get out of this cycle of addiction. Or I'm just a weak person, I'm just not very clever, and so I'm short of money because I can't find a job. You see, it's not just that the truth and grace comes to just solve those problems for you. The grace and truth comes to truly deal with your biggest problem, which is that you can't face the glory of God. It's not as though you've got a few things wrong in your life and you just need God to give you a bit of a leg up. And once those are sorted out and you've got a more stable life and you're in a happy family or something, that'll be all right. You can't face God, and yet in Jesus you can. And he solves that because he comes full of grace and truth. And so we need to hear about grace and truth. Not just God's got a gift for us that's going to make our life a bit better, but that God's got a gift for us that in truth will solve your biggest problem, which is your alienation from God, your hostility to God, and his hostility to you, that you can't face his glory. And we all need to hear that and to believe in this Jesus who comes as the Word of life, becoming flesh, revealing the glory of God, and offering us grace and truth.